Hello, fellow readers. I'm your host, Fasti Karlitz. Today's episode is all about literary prizes. We start off with an interview with Irena Sinokoje, the recent winner of the 2020 Kane Prize, and then Book Launch staff talk about some books they've enjoyed so far from this year's Booker Prize longlist. Welcome to A Reader's Community, a podcast brought to you by the Book Launch. The last few weeks saw big moments in the literary calendar. The Booker Prize longlist and the winner of the Kane Prize were announced. Literary prizes are such major events in the book world because they are so significant in shaping that year's reading and the career of the authors that win them. Prizes like these mean that the nominated authors will be read. The Kane Prize started with this exact objective. It's a prize for African short story writing that aims to highlight the excellent writing happening from Africa and the diaspora, and to make sure that the rest of the world pays attention to this writing in a way that it historically has not. And it succeeded. Many writers who have won have then gone on to become major names in the African and global literary scene, such as Helen Habila, Namwali Sopell, and Leila Abulela. We are lucky enough to have the 21st winner of the Kane Prize as today's guest, Irena Sinokoje.
I've been following the Kane Prize for years. It's one of these prizes that's on the scene that you pay attention to because there's been such an amazing alumni of writers that have come from this, and it's such a great platform.
Later in the episode, we'll hear from Book Launch staff about books from the Booker long list that they've enjoyed. This year's list is diverse, and even though there are some familiar, established writers on it, like Hilary Mantel and Anne Tyler, the majority of the longlisted authors are debut novelists. The fresh and vibrant new voices make this year's list particularly exciting to me, and we'll hear about four of those debut novels from staff, as well as one of the African books that was longlisted. But first, I talked to Irena Sinokoje about her prize-winning short story called Grace Jones. It's such a privilege. It's so wonderful to have you on the podcast, Irena Sin. I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself, if you don't mind.
Yes, sure. Thank you so much for having me. My name's Irena Sinokoje. I'm a writer. I've written three books, one novel and two short story collections. I'm in London, actually, at the moment. I'm based in East London, so I'm really happy to be connecting with you guys from here.
Firstly, congratulations on winning the prize.
Thank you.
I read Grace Jones for the first time last year, and I absolutely loved it, so I wasn't surprised at all when you won.
Oh, that's so nice.
What does it mean for you to have won this?
Oh, I mean, it means a lot to me. I've won and been shortlisted for awards before, but this is very special to me because it's an African-focused prize, and, you know, there's something about the timing of this that makes it feel even more important somehow, you know, with this pandemic happening and everything that we're going through. And I honestly never actually expected this. I was very happy to be shortlisted. It's such an excellent group of writers. They're all brilliant. So I really was just overwhelmed, and I'm really happy because it means that you know, my writing can be introduced more to an African audience, because I feel like that hasn't happened enough yet. So that's also very, very important to me.
So your story is about a young woman, Sidra, who has a key traumatic event in her youth, but in the present day works as a Grace Jones impersonator.
Yeah.
She wears Grace Jones kind of as an armor, or as a way to seem invincible, even though she's quite vulnerable. And I wanted to ask, why do you think she chooses Grace Jones as her armor?
Right. Great question. Well, firstly, it's just me as an author for selfish reasons, because I love Grace Jones. I'm a huge fan of hers. And, you know, she, I think, is a really inspiring character, and actually a real innovator. If you think about her career and the way she looks, she sort of has that amazing androgynous look, I think, that has inspired, you know, so many people, you know, in the LGBTQ community as well. So Grace is somebody that's really important to me, and I've always wanted to somehow find a way to write about her. So this idea of, you know, a young woman struggling with this trauma came to me, and I thought, God, wouldn't it be great to have her do like a celebrity impersonator, like side hustle? You know, wouldn't that be great? And then I was thinking, well, who could it be? And Grace, of course, came to the forefront. And of course, Sidra physically looks like Grace as well. So I thought, you know, creating that element as well makes it feel like much more of a strong connection. And of course, Grace is so larger than life. Mm. You know, if you think about it, she's almost the sort of perfect foil to hide behind if you're somebody that wants to kind of disappear, you know, that doesn't really want to face up to who you are. Because of course, Sidra as a personality is very different to Grace. Mm. You know, who she actually is very different to who Grace is. But she uses Grace, like you said, as an armor, as a way of being able to navigate through the world, you know, and while she's hiding these secrets and these sort of reenactments that she's doing in order to cope with her past trauma.
Absolutely. I wanted to pick up on something that the Kane Prize judges mentioned when in their write-up about your story, which is how one way to read the story is about performing blackness in white spaces. Mm. Because Sidra, as Grace Jones, is going to these completely white parties.
Yes.
She's often the only black woman there, unless there's a Tina Turner impersonator. And what I thought was so interesting about that is that, so she has access, but that access is predicated on her performing a very particular kind of blackness, which is Grace Jones. Mm. And I was thinking about how often when marginalized people are given access to spaces, they have to perform their identity in exactly the right way.
Yes.
In order to be welcome there.
Absolutely.
And I was wondering if that fit into your story.
100%. That's why that scene is in there, you know, because I could have written a really short scene in terms of her like doing the Grace Jones aspect of her life and that role, but I really wanted to make it as vivid and detailed as possible. And yes, this idea of blackness, as you said, you know, you figure out, I think, as a black person and as a person of color, that when you try to access certain spaces, you know, you see what sort of blackness that people are actually looking for. And sometimes it's an unspoken thing.
Yeah.
You know, you intuitively pick up on what it is they're looking for. And sometimes you respond accordingly, and then sometimes you don't. And if you don't respond accordingly, you know, you may not be invited back. You know, it's kind of a really interesting thing, like this idea of reward and punishment and types of blackness and, you know, how we have to perform it sometimes, you know. So with somebody like Grace Jones, of course, Grace Jones is a huge star, and, you know, people love what she represents, you know, the kind of edginess and excitement that she brings. So Sidra is bringing that to this party as Grace, and of course they all gravitate towards it, they all love it. You know, but we see later on in the party with the character Luigi, who's the host, you know, of course he loves Grace Jones, but then later on when he's completely inebriated, we find this character, he actually reacts quite aggressively towards Sidra.
Yeah.
And you know, the mask comes off. It's almost like he doesn't actually fully see her as a person anymore in that instance, you know. So I thought that complexity was important to show, in that people can want, you know, your blackness or a particular sort of blackness in that space if they feel like it adds something to it, like it adds some sort of value. But, you know, if you put a foot wrong, and you don't do it the way they expect you to, you can also be punished for it, you know. So it's fascinating to me, like, that, you know, blackness is fascinating to me, which is, I, you know, I write about it a lot, but I try to come at it from different angles. So for me, it was really interesting that the judges picked up on that, because it was a key part of the story.
Yeah, and accessing those spaces, it seems desirable. It seems like something you would want. Like, who wouldn't want to go to, I mean, such a lavish party and get all the free drinks? But it's a dangerous space for her to occupy. It's a fraught existence when she's there. It's not as simple as, once you get in, you can have a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. And she's aware of all of that. You know, Sidra, I think, is an intelligent character, and she knows that, you know, she knows what happens in the space. She, you know, she even jokes about the fact that, you know, when she talks about Tina Turner being the only other black woman, and, you know, and that's quite a funny thing, because also it's a funny thing, it's an interesting thing when you're not the only black person, and it might be a few of you, and and that's also interesting as well, because, you know, are you nice to each other, do you pretend like you don't see the other person?
Yeah. I mean, but she always makes it sound like two's a crowd.
Yeah absolutely.
There really is only space for one.
Yeah, it's like, well, if Tina was here, I'd be fighting for attention. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, oh, I'm glad Tina's not here.
Which is also very revealing about blackness in white spaces, yeah. You know, that there's so little room.
This is it. This is it. And I think that that's not, obviously, that's not the fault of black people.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, we are many and multiple and varied in what we bring. You know, it's about other people actually seeing that and actually understanding that there should be space for more, you know, that's the issue.
Yeah. There's this decadence in your writing, this vividness and sensuality. And it's a really sexy story, I thought.
Thank you.
And I came across this line recently where Grace Jones describes herself as both a sensualist and a surrealist. And I thought that was just an absolutely accurate description of your story and of your writing, because you often have these surreal elements as well in your short stories. And I know that it's actually a little bit less so in Grace Jones. There are more surreal elements in the other stories in Nudibranch.
Yes, yeah.
But could you talk a little bit about how you incorporate surrealism and I almost want to call it weirdness into your imagery?
I love that. Thank you for that note on Grace saying that, actually. That makes me feel really good. It's like, yeah, that's just perfect. Yeah, I do think, I'm glad you said it's a sexy story. And the thing is, for me, I think it's really important to write about sensuality and sexuality and not shy away from it. Like, here in England, I noticed that literary writers don't like to write about sex. And I find that really weird because we all have sex and it's great and it's part of the human experience. But for me, it's like fun to write about it or find ways of incorporating it into the story. And of course, I think when we think about black women in particular, you know, so much of our lives are hidden, you know, and often those sides of us are hidden or police where, you know, we're either hypersexualized or we're just not visible at all. So you get either end. And it's just this odd thing. But actually, it's nice to be able to write about us in a way that feels fully formed, in a way that sort of looks at all the different aspects of us, not just like the pain, you know, because we do know the pain, and the pain is very political, but also the sensuality, you know, the sensuality of women and the sensuality of black women and women of colour. So I like to incorporate that. It's interesting that you said that Grace Jones is, I think it's probably one of the more accessible stories in the collection because the collection is really very weird. but Grace has elements of weirdness in it, you know, and it's like, I think it's a good balance of being weird, but like not too crazy, because a couple of the stories in the collection, you know, some people have said, what the hell was going on in that story? Like, that story was so weird. But you know, but the thing is, Grace herself is like a weird artist. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like just in principle, like Grace just inhabits that space, I think, so effortlessly. But what's amazing about Grace that I love is, you know, her blackness is unapologetic, you know, like just look at her. It's completely unapologetic. Mm. Her weirdness is completely unapologetic. You know, she's like something from another dimension. So I wanted to kind of bring that into this story, but sort of anchored with this trauma, you know, this idea of this terrible thing that's happened to Sidra that she just can't shake the guilt of it away. And of course, in her adult life, she finds almost ways of sort of re-traumatizing herself while still wanting help, but not being able to ask for help, you know. So that the psychology of that it was really interesting to me to be able to explore that.
Can we give spoilers? Because I kind of want to talk about the fact that she's an arsonist as well. Like, she has this compulsion.
Yes.
Like you say, to re-traumatize herself. But her trauma is so well written that at no point could I manufacture any kind of condemnation of her.
Yeah, I think I was, you know, one of the things that I'm really interested in, as you've seen from the collection probably, is I really like to write complicated women. I think it's really important to do that because often women, you know, we're not allowed to sort of inhabit every kind of space or emotion. And I find that really annoying, you know, because sometimes things happen and you do have feelings of anger and fury and, you know, wanting to enact some sort of revenge sometimes. So I like to like incorporate that in my women characters, because of course we're all human. And the thing is, sometimes people will say, I would never do that. I would never behave in that way. But you don't know what you would behave like unless you're in a situation, until something terrible happens to you. You know, you don't know how you might respond to it psychologically. It might just push you over the edge to do things you would never think of doing, or to kind of find really strange ways of coping with it. So I think that's what I try to show. I really, writing for me is also about empathy. You know, it's an investigation into the human condition for me. And I want, you know, readers to be able to empathize with these characters. And I don't want to make them perfect. And I certainly don't want to write perfect women characters as well, because it's just like, it's holding us to a different standard that's not fair, you know, because men are allowed to be bastards and rakes and get away with stuff and be empathetic anti-heroes, you know. So I think, like, you know, I write anti-heroines, and, you know, it's kind of like fun for me to do that, because we should be able to fully encompass and express all sorts of things, everything from fury to, you know, to disappointment to trauma and what that looks like. And, you know, I want the reader to be fully invested in the character, you know, so even if they might do things that you don't agree with, you can kind of empathize with them. You sort of understand it in a way, because you think, God, you never, like, you're really quite messed up, you know, like, you're in there as a good person, but you've not been able to recover from what happened to you. And, you know, this is how you deal with it, you know. So it's just this thing of like creating a world, like a mini world. I think a good short story always leaves you wanting more.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, like feeling like you just like, you love those characters.
Yeah, my favorite kind of short story is one that sketches a complete world. Mm. You know, you feel like the world doesn't just exist in these 3 or 5 or 8 pages.
Yes.
Like, it's the whole world exists behind it. And also, it was just remarkable to me what a complicated character you managed to sketch with so few pages. Mm. So what is it like for you, because you've written a novel as well, and I think I read somewhere that you're working on a second novel.
Yes, I am, yeah.
How is the process of short story writing different for you to novel writing?
I love writing short stories. I'm really obsessive with my short stories. It's such a feverish process for me, and I think that shows in the writing, because I'm just excited to get the ideas on the page, and I think the form allows me to be experimental, because it's such a great form. You know, you can write a story as a prose poem, you can write a story as a series of vignettes or postcard-like writing, you know, you can write sort of longer short stories, you can write mini short stories. So there's a lot that you can do with it, and I think people are doing really exciting, interesting things with the form. And of course, I feel like, you know, short stories help me find who I am as a writer. Mm. This is why I love them so much, because I had written the first draft of my novel and I was just so fed up of it by that point. I just was like, I never want to see this for another like 2 years. I'm really like been driven to the point of madness and I need a break from that world. But I didn't want to completely give up writing. And I had like a short story collection by a great writer called Dennis Johnson. Mm. For 7 years I had that collection, and it's a short, really short collection, but it's mind blowing. It's called Jesus's Son, and it was a collection about, you know, a drug addict on the fringes, a series of interconnected stories about this drug addict. But what I loved about this collection was that it was surreal, it was funny, it was realistic, but it just made you have this amazing empathy for this character who most people wouldn't really care about, but it just brought you into his world so beautifully. And I was blown away. I thought, wow, short stories can do this. Yeah. I was always somebody that just read novels. I had no idea that you could be that emotionally invested in short pieces. So then I started writing. I said, I want to try this. You know. So then I started writing short stories, and I found London. And of course, there's an ending with short stories. That's the other thing that's great. You know, you can work on a novel and feel like, oh my God, it's just never going to be over. But with a short story, I think the shortness of the form means that your excitement carries you through it.
Right.
You know, so you realize the idea, and then while you're writing it, you're having other ideas for other stories, you know. So it's just a really exciting, feverish process for me. So I love it. Equally, I love novel writing because, you know, you have much more scope to, you know, really live in a world and really sort of, you know, create these dimensions to these characters over quite, you know, a long space of time. So they both give different things, but I think it's nice to be able to do both, because when I'm struggling with the novel, often I'll write short stories and I'll feel reinvigorated to go back to the novel. You know, I felt quite intimidated working on my first novel, but by the time I'd written the stories in the first collection, I went back and sort of psychologically tricked myself in my approach. So I saw the chapters in the novel as a series of shorts that just happened to be connected. So that was kind of how I got around that. So I feel like in the sort of ecosystem of, you know, my sort of weird brain and world, like, they kind of feed into each other, which is a nice thing.
Yeah. Are you using that methodology for your current novel as well, like switching between the two?
Oh yeah, definitely. Like, I'm in halfway through writing this novel, but I've also written one or two short pieces while I've been writing it, just one or two commissions. Okay. which is nice, because it means that you take some space away from that world, you create something new, something completely different, and then it just kind of gives you, I don't know, the drive to go back to it, and it makes you see it in a slightly different way, you know. So yeah.
So we had Remy Ngamije on the second episode of our podcast.
Oh, he's brilliant. I love Remy.
And I know that you two were in Afro Lit together.
Yes.
And I also know that Remy made a playlist for your story. He's got a really good playlist. All the playlists he made for the Cane Prize shortlists were really, really good.
Yeah, I thought it was really great, and it energized all of us. We were all like, oh my God, this is so cool that he, and just the generosity to do that as well, I thought was really sweet. But also indicative of him as a personality, because it's just, he's a generous writer. I'm sure you had fun with him on the podcast.
So much fun. He's so much fun. It's been so lovely talking to you. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's such a joy. I really enjoyed it. Great questions as well. I could have talked for ages, I reckon.
But... yeah, that was wonderful. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Arenason Okoje's latest collection, Nudibranch, in which Grace Jones was first published, is available at the Book Lounge. The Booker Prize is arguably the most esteemed literary prize in the world, and for many readers, the winning book automatically makes its way to the to-be-read list. We wanted to take you through some of the books we've read and enjoyed so far from the long list, starting with Luami's choice.
My name is Luami. I really love sad and beautiful books. There's a lot of really good debuts on this year's list. The one that I am talking about is How Much of These Heels is Gold by C. Pam Zhang. It starts off with two siblings. Their father has just died. They're very young, and they're going out into the wilderness to find a place to bury his body. It's set during the gold rush years in San Francisco. Their father was a prospector, and their mother came across from China with a promise of, like, having a new job and a new life building the railway stations, but ends up basically in a forced labor situation. So the story focuses a lot on who gets to call themselves American and who gets to live on the land, and who does America belong to, and what does it mean to be American. The story follows the two siblings trying to figure out what their place is in the society that keeps rejecting them, and how the one keeps trying to fit in while the other one just breaks away. It was really beautifully written. It's very sad, but very poetic. And I just love a coming-of-age story with a bit of a different perspective for a change. One other thing that I really loved about the book was just her way of talking about the landscape. Like, she's constantly talking about the beauty of the landscape, and that's part of what keeps drawing the characters into this love of the land, is because it's so part of who they are, and it was just really beautiful. If you liked something like Sebastian Barry, you should definitely read this. really well written. It was a really interesting story. I really liked the questions it raised. I really love this. I would highly recommend it.
Next up, Onati talks about one of two African books longlisted for the Booker.
My name is Onati Maegiso. The book that I'm talking about today is The Shadow King by Maza Mengiste. The book is poetic historical fiction that's based in the Second Italo-Ethiopian War, which can also be called the Mussolini 1935 invasion. This book explores the woman's perspective in the war, how they were involved in the war. The book starts off exploring relationships between two women, basically Herod and Esther. And from there, it builds into different types of struggles that women go through. I'd say I have never read a book that's as beautiful written as this one. I don't think you can like read it in one go. It's very beautiful, but then you have to also give it time. But at the end, I feel like it's a very necessary, beautiful read. It's poetic, lyrical, and very, very beautiful.
Next up, Jess's recommendation.
I am Jess, the kids books buyer for the Book Lounge. Such a Fun Age is a debut novel by Kylie Reid. I love this book. I think that I've also read a lot of quite bad reviews, people that are like, oh, there's so much hype and I don't get it. But I think that that's because quite a surface reading of the book is this millennial melodrama. I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing with my life? Who am I? Do my friends like me? How will I make money? But I think that Kylie Reid is like quite genius in her accessible way of writing with insight into casual racism and emotional labor as transaction. So Amira is the main character. She's like 25. She's a black woman who is the babysitter for Briar. And her mom, Alex, is Amira's employer. It makes it so complicated that Alex is paying Amira to love her kid. But I felt like it was also just like quite genuine and honest. And I think reading about it afterward, Kylie Reid was a babysitter as well. She spent, I think, 6 years doing that. And so for her experiencing also that creating a real love and relationship with a kid, but being paid to do that and then still navigating that family relationship while being othered, coming from that, like from her personal experience, I think is also really interesting. It's quite an easy and also fun read. It is. It almost reads more like it's written for like a screen adaptation. It's almost supposed to be like a TV show in some of the ways that it's written, at least in the dialogue. And sometimes like that gets in the way or it breaks things up. But at the same time, I found it really easy. It's not a challenging read at all. It's very simple. And I think that sometimes when things are easy and simple like that, it also disguises the genius. You maybe don't pick up on certain things that are really insightful because of the writing, in a way. And I feel like I've experienced the same thing maybe with Zadie Smith, actually.
Finally, Mervyn shares two debut novels he's read from the long list. One of the books he's going to talk about is called Real Life by Brandon Taylor, and I just have to jump in here and say that I loved this book. It's one of the best books I've read this year, and in fact, in a long time. I also highly recommend this book.
Hi, I'm Mervyn, owner of the Book Lounge. I'm going to talk briefly about a couple of books on the Booker long list. One is a wonderful novel called Real Life, written by Brandon Taylor. But first, I'm going to talk about the book that I'm reading at the moment, and that is a book called Shuggy Bane. It's a debut novel written by a Scottish writer called Douglas Stewart. So one of the things that prizes like the Booker do is they shine a light on books and encourage people to read books that they wouldn't necessarily have picked up. And Shuggy Bane is exactly that for me. I was blissfully unaware of its existence until it was featured on the long list. It is a very, very gritty, grim in a lot of ways, novel set in working class Glasgow about a family, various members of the family. Shuggy, the character who gives the book its title, is a young kid in a broken family, and much of the novel centers on the relationship between him and his mother, who is a pretty desperate alcoholic, at times in recovery, at times not. We're talking about poor people, we're talking about broken families, we're talking about broken communities. There are parts of it which reminded me, and this will only mean something to older listeners of the podcast, Frank McCourt's memoir, Angela's Ashes. But this, of course, is fiction, not a memoir. But there is something also quite beautiful about it, which I think is about the resilience, particularly of Shaggy, of the kid, and his path, and how he is actually making sense of himself in this world. One imagines a wonderful future for a young, creative, fabulous Shaggy who has emerged from the most dreadful circumstances. As I said, it's grim, but I'm also loving it. Maybe that's something to do with lockdown. I don't know. The other book I want to talk about, as I said, is Real Life, written by Brandon Taylor, another debut novel on the Man Bucket Long List this year. This book isn't out in South Africa yet. It is, the latest indications are that it will be released sometime in September. But I was fortunate enough to get an advanced copy, which I read in the early stages of lockdown. As the title suggests, Real Life, it is apparently fairly autobiographical. It is an outstanding novel, which I also found very, very disturbing. The narrator, Wallace, is black, he's queer, he's from the South, this is in the States, and he's part of a very intense sort of biochemistry postgrad group at an unnamed American university. And this group, kind of, they work ridiculously long hours, they are under intense pressure, and so the relationships within this group become very, very important and very, very kind of pivotal. Most of the novel takes place over a weekend, and there's a series of very intense interactions. I use the word intense a lot when talking about this book, between Wallace and his friends and colleagues, and they're all white. And these interactions show how Wallace is part but not part of this group. And that's a lot of that has to do with being the one black kid in the white group. There's also some very disturbing and violent sexual relationship that develops over the weekend between Wallace and Miller, who is sort of characterized as a straight white male part of the group. And the sort of intensity and disturbing nature of that sort of also ratchets up as the weekend progresses. It's an incredibly contemporary novel. It feels young and smart. It's dialogue rich in the way that very different writers who are trying to capture something about kind of the present moment are, you know, the obvious example being somebody like Sally Rooney, Niece Dolan, those kind of young writers. But there's also, for me, there's a nod to sort of an older tradition, a sort of European existentialist thing. The key thing for me about this book is the central character, Wallace, and he feels like a man who's hiding in plain sight. He's suffering these constant aggressions, these racist sort of slights, but he's so complex in his own kind of history, his own desires, his own contradictions, that he resists feeling like an object or a victim of what's going on around him. Ultimately, it is an incredibly poignant study of alienation, generational, racial, sexual, academic, all different interlocked levels of alienation, which again feels incredibly apposite for where we are right now. I think it's a quite brilliant novel, and I can't wait for it to be available here for South African readers, as I say, in September.
That's our show. The Book Lounge is an independent bookstore in Cape Town, which you can support by ordering books to be delivered to your home. We'd love to hear any feedback or comments from you, so please do get in touch via email. Our email address is booklounge@gmail.com. You can find all the titles mentioned in this episode in the description. Thanks to Irena Sinokoje for getting on a call with me. Our producer is Andre Burnett. Thanks for listening, everyone. We will be with you again in 2 weeks. Until then, keep reading.